Hey there. You're listening to This Song, the podcast where artists talk about the songs that formed and transformed them. I'm your host, Elizabeth McQueen, and on this episode of This Song, you're going to hear from singer and songwriter and author Amanda Palmer. But before we get started, I want to let you know that, yes, South by Southwest is over, but that doesn't mean you can't still experience some of what went down during the festival. The team here at KUTX, the radio station where we make this podcast, collected tons of audio and video and pictures during South By, so if you missed our morning broadcast from the Four Seasons, or you want to see one of the pop-up sessions we did with bands like Phony People or Ilabamba, just head to our website, kutx.org. We have got you covered. One of the things that happened during South by Southwest was that I got to sit down and chat with Amanda Palmer. If you're not familiar with her work, well, let me give you a quick primer. She started out in the early 2000s in the cabaret rock duo The Dresden Dolls, and around 2007, 2008, she started releasing music under her own name and with various collaborators. In 2012, Amanda Palmer became the first artist to raise over $1 million on Kickstarter for her record Theater is Evil, a fact which actually opened her up to a massive wave of criticism around how she ran her band and interacted with her fans. That experience led her to write an incredibly popular TED Talk called The Art of Asking. She wrote a book, also called The Art of Asking, expanding on the ideas on that talk. And then she kind of took a break from the commercial world. She signed up with Patreon, a digital platform that has revived the idea of artistic patronage. Patreon allows fans to support artists, not just by buying the things they make, but by continually contributing small amounts of money directly to the artists so that they can make art or whatever it is they make. Amanda Palmer has over 15,000 patrons, and these patrons get a continuous connection with Amanda in the form of almost daily blog posts, demos, web chats, all kinds of things. And that's where she's been concentrating her artistic efforts until very recently. Amanda Palmer just released her first solo record in 7 years. It's called There Will Be No Intermission, and it's a collection of devastatingly cathartic songs that cover this really intense period in her life. The songs tackle her experiences with death and birth and abortion and miscarriages and, you know, the general sense of unease that many of us feel in the world right now. Now, before we get into this interview, I want to let you know a couple of things. One, this is a long interview. Like, normally I edit these interviews down to 15 or 20 minutes, but this was a live interview and Amanda Palmer said a lot of good stuff and I kept most of it. So it's closer to like 40 minutes and there's a lot of language, like the F word. And there are discussions about intense subjects like death and abortion. So if you have littles or you yourself are not in a place to hear about those things right now, you might want to listen to this episode another time, though I do hope you will listen to it when you can. So without further ado, here's Amanda Palmer, recorded live at South by Southwest.
Well, this request came in at an interesting time because when it came in last week, I was deep in the process of doing interviews all day, every day for this record that I'm putting out. So you probably would have gotten a different answer a year ago, 2 years ago, but I found myself constantly returning to this record by Nick Cave, Skeleton Tree. And I think it's a hallmark of a really great record when you think of an entire record and it's very hard to pinpoint which song on that record because the entire album is so powerful just as one listen. So it was an interesting exercise to go to the album and look at the track list, and I actually hadn't really looked at the track list of the album and thought about it as a separate pile of songs. And I thought, if I'm gonna talk about one of these songs, which is the one that sort of most embodies what the record feels like, and that was really hard to do, which I think is another reason that the record's brilliant. It's an important assemblage of a bunch of different things that make up one really beautiful whole, and you can't just pull one slice out of it, but I tried.
And what song did you finally settle on?
Magneto
Mostly I never knew which way was out. Once it was on, and that was that. The umbilicus was a faucet that found in rabbit blood, and I spun on my wheel. Like a laboratory rat.
I'm a Nick Cave fan, like old school fan. I got my first Nick Cave tape when I was 14 and was fully invested. And I had just had a baby, and my nanny was also a Nick Cave fan. Thank Christ, right? So she told me that, because she'd been paying more attention to the internet than I had, that Nick Cave's documentary, One More Time with Feeling, was going to be shown in theaters for one night only all around the country. And we were in rural upstate New York, and so we drove all the way to Albany. Like, I felt like a teenager again. It's like, we're going to drive to Albany to see a movie. And I was so moved by the experience of seeing that film that I found time that I didn't have over the next 48 hours, and I wrote an article about it for The Guardian, about how watching Nick Cave, not only after losing his son, not only keep making his record. He was in the middle of making a record, and he just was like, I'm going to keep doing this. But on top of that, I'm going to invite in a film crew to capture the process of me capturing my grief with my band in this room. In this age right now of total selfie culture, there are two ways you could look at that. You could look at it as a really flailing, narcissistic artist move, or you could look at it the way I looked at it, which is an act of extreme generosity that I think certain artists get to at a certain point when they realize that the ability to walk into the dark and carefully take people with you is why we do our jobs. And I was going through a rough time. I had just had a child. I was very confused. I wasn't writing very much. I knew I wanted to work on an album, but I didn't really know exactly how to assemble it or what else needed to be on it. And watching Nick Cave doing that was basically just like an invitation. You know, you can write about anything. You can write about your grief. You can write about how hard it is to be a mother. Like, you don't need anyone's fucking permission to do that. You're an artist. This is your job. Sit in your grief, use it, you're allowed to use it. It's not selfish, it's not narcissistic, it's actually generous to do that. And I didn't need anyone else to authenticate that, because he was up there on screen doing it and I was sitting there in the audience crying. That's all the permission I needed to be reminded that this is the job we do.
My monstrous little memory, it swallowed me whole. It was the year I officially became the bride of Jesus. In love, you laugh, in love, you move, I move, and one more time with feeling. Love, you love, I love, you love, saw you in heart, the stars are splashed across the ceiling.
One of the things that is so beautiful about this record and this song is, and this is sort of a topic that I've been thinking about a lot lately as I I'm kind of confronted with this record that I just made, and now I'm having to talk to people about it, and I'm having to reckon with what it is that I just did. Because you don't really think very much about what you're doing while you're doing it. But when you sit and you talk to 90 journalists about it, you kind of have to confront and accept your own work. And a lot of what I've been thinking about that shows up in this Nick Cave song is, you know, when I have chosen as a songwriter, when I've chosen metaphor, vagueness, poetry, you can't really pin this down, this is some beautiful poetic vague idea, I don't even maybe know what it's about, that style, versus when to just be very direct. And I've been, you know, not very consciously, but certainly subconsciously, making that little decision as a songwriter since I started writing songs when I was 12. When do you say it directly and just like stick it on the table? And when do you cover it in, you know, what we could just call fiction or poetry or, you know, the art shroud? And a lot of the music that I listened to as a teenager was like covered in shroud, you know, I was a goth. And a lot of the bands that I listened to, like The Cure and Depeche Mode and Robin Hitchcock or Bjork or whatever, you were just like, I don't fucking know what this is about. It just sounds awesome. And, you know, it creates a feeling. And in this song, Nick Cave just like, he does like a full first to fifth gear all over this record and all over this song, going dancing from the metaphoric and the who knows to lines like, come as far as the edge of my blood and swim. And in the bathroom mirror, I see me vomit in the sink.
Come as far as the edge of my blood, then swim. And in the bathroom mirror, I see me vomit in the sink.
Like, just in those two lines, we're not really sure what line one means, but we know what line two means. And he just takes you back and forth between images that are totally interpretable and ones that you're just forced to face. And I mean the line about the supermarket.
Oh, the urge to kill somebody was basically overwhelming. Such hard blues down there in the supermarket queues.
It's just like, you can just see it. You can just see this guy, this father who's just lost his son in Brighton, England, going down to the, you know, going down to the Sainsbury's and standing in line to get a sandwich and actually beginning to weep and facing the reality of losing a child. You know, he says in the documentary, he looks around, he talks about that moment. And he looks around and he says, I had this thought, like everyone is being so nice to me, but when did I become an object of pity? And hearing these things is like, you know, as human beings, We like and tend to shy away from the dark, but hearing someone speaking openly and generously about these experiences is so important if we're gonna be real.
I love you, love, I love you, love. We saw each other in heart, and all the stars are splashed and splattered across the ceiling.
Well, so at the time that you saw
this Nick Cave movie and you're really hearing this song, it sounds like that you were in a place and it wasn't the best place. Were you making music at the time? I mean, you've been prolific throughout your career and you've never really stopped. But as far as the music that you were making and the songs that you were making, is there a before and after? Like what I was making before I had that experience and then what changed?
Maybe. I probably, let's see, at the point that I heard this song when this record came out and that film came out, I had probably assembled about 60% of the record. I had just written, it's funny, I had just written a song that wound up on the record called A Mother's Confession, which is, it's kind of the funniest song on the record, but it's also not funny. It's a kind of a stream of consciousness song about how overwhelming it feels to be the mother of a 3-month-old baby with all of the changes and the lack of sleep and the disorientation and the kind of the terror that goes along with it.
Our son is 4 months old. His name is Anthony, or Ash for short, and he's too small to do things by himself. We were in LA over Christmas in a rental, and we jury-rigged a place to change his diapers on a shelf. I was peeing in the bathroom and had left for just a second, 'cause I thought he couldn't move and he was safe. As I came out, I saw him falling in slow motion to the floor. It was probably the worst moment of my life.
And it was the sort of song that I never imagined would live past its little funny flash moment of I'm gonna write this song, you know, in a couple of hours, then I'm gonna put it up tomorrow on my Patreon, and it's gonna be this funny thing I once did that everyone's gonna forget about. But then I started playing it at shows, thinking that it would just be a funny novelty moment once or twice. And I had, it was almost always, you know, 99% of the time, parents coming up to me after I would play this song, crying, saying, thank you so much for saying what I've always felt but I've never said. And one of the things I think is so important about live performance and connecting with audiences and not just living in a bubble is I kind of didn't know how powerful the song was until I took it out there and people told me that it was powerful. You know, to me, it just felt like this sort of novelty trifle. But then I watched it doing its work and I was like, oh, well, then I guess I'm being told what this song is. This song is useful. It's, you know, music can, like this, you know, like this Nick Cave song. Maybe not for everybody, maybe not all the time, but this is like, the song is like palliative care. It's medicine for the person who needs it when they need it. And I sort of felt the same way about A Mother's Confession. And part of it was also, you know, remembering, you know, music's really changed. We forget, especially like we're here at South by Southwest, it's all about like streaming and how do we capture views and likes, and you know, the commodification of music has fully happened, and how do we capture the money around the music? And everyone just collectively forgets music had a fucking purpose. Music didn't used to be about buying and selling. Music was made for sharing and healing and communicating and teaching. Right? Like, right? Like, this whole put it on a thing and sell it is really, really new. And I think has really fucked us up. And, you know, this song this moment and that moment that I had with Nick Cave in that theater, if I had been faltering and sort of forgetting, it really reminded me. I don't need any validation from a streaming service or a record label to tell me that these songs are or aren't good. It's not about that. It's about the fact that this mother, this father came up to me after they heard that song and wept in my arms. That's the only information I need about whether this song is valid.
Well, and that brings me to something that I also got really into when I was researching this, was that I actually joined your Patreon. I am a dollar a month patron because I had a feeling that there was some kind of core relation to your work, which of course there is. But one of the things that I didn't expect was that some of the songs on these records are not just about you doing a one-way communication out. They've been like an exercise in two-way communication between yourself and your patrons. So The Ride, which is the first song on the new record, absolutely, I cannot not cry when I hear that song.
Everyone's too scared to open their eyes up, but everyone's too scared to close them. Everyone's frightened, they don't know what's coming, but everyone's frightened of knowing. Everyone's reading the rules of engagement, and everyone's starting to doubt them. Everyone's reaching to put on a seatbelt, but this kind of ride comes without them.
And I actually played it in the car with my kids coming home from school the other day, which, by the way...
Oh, my God. How old are your kids?
They're 10 and 7. They found Evelyn on the internet. And, yeah, like, we're playing it. And I was like, whoa, you need to run by some of those songs. Like, make sure they're okay.
Yeah, they're a bit dark.
They're pretty... They love dark. And actually, my daughter requested The Ride on their way to school this morning. Like, not even... I didn't even have to ask her. But I was in the car. I'm driving home with my kids. And I'm listening to The Ride. And I'm crying. And I'm thinking, how did she know all this stuff? How did Amanda Palmer know to write this song that I needed so much? And then I realized, because she asked people. So that song, you actually went to your patrons and said, tell me something that you're afraid of, and got all these responses, and then wrote a song around that. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that aspect of communication, like the two-way interaction.
You know, it gets back to what we were just talking about what music can do when we do it together. When I read those 1,500 comments, I didn't have a game plan. I was like, maybe one person will write one thing about their dead goldfish or their, or whatever happened to them this morning, and that will just spark an idea. And the thing that sparked an idea after reading those 1,500 comments was one guy saying, my prompt was just tell me what you're afraid of. Keep it short. Less than 5,000 words, please. I only have a day to write this song. I have to read your comments too. And this one guy commented, I'm not afraid of anything anymore because I just remember what Bill Hicks said. It's just a ride. And I was like, oh, I love you. I need to go procrastinate right now and go watch Bill Hicks. I need to go down a Bill Hicks YouTube wormhole. But I knew exactly the monologue he was talking about, and I was sitting there at the piano with my laptop, and I just flipped over to Bill Hicks, who isn't with us anymore and still transmitting this beautiful message through the YouTube screen.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round, it has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people. Shut him up.
And it was such a beautiful combination of, like, mic dropping, philosophical, spiritual truth, and really funny. And I thought, wow, am I allowed to just steal that? I can fucking do anything I want. I'm stealing that. And I'm taking all of these details from this blog, which had piled up on one side and then another. Like, the amazing thing about reading those blog comments, which you can go read, is there was an equal and opposite experience at every turn. Some people had just lost babies. Some people had had them and couldn't handle it. Some people were estranged from their parents. Some people were dealing with their parents in hospice. Some people couldn't find love and were feeling desperately alone. Some people were in abusive situations that they couldn't escape. And I was like, everyone is suffering. The brand, you know, everyone's got their own brand. But the piles were really high all around me. And I just looked around thinking, wow, we're all just here on this ride in the shit, you know. And everyone's afraid of something, and everyone is carrying pain, always something.
But it's just a ride. It's just a ride. From the sister you miss to the father you don't wanna write. It's just a ride. It's just a ride. From the lover you left to the one that you're frightened to find. It's just a ride. It's just a ride. From the baby you lost to the one that you're growing inside. Come on out, darling, and don't you cry. It's just a ride.
And the beautiful thing about being on Patreon is that when I sat down and I wrote the first draft of the song, and it was 11 minutes, and I sat down and I was like, well, clearly this needs to be edited down. Songs aren't 11 minutes. But I can't take out that part. I can't. And I was like, well, fuck it. I'm not on a label anymore. No one's going to argue with me that a song can't be 11 minutes. This song is 11 minutes long. Also, I think maybe inspired by Nick Cave and other artists who, you know, or Leonard Cohen, who are just like, this is just what this song is. You know, I don't care if it doesn't follow radio format. This fucker's 11 minutes long. They deal with it.
So having your patrons there and having that support system and that community, that gave you kind of the permission and ability to just to make the record that you wanted to make? Or that you needed to make?
Yeah, and it's actually something that just occurred to me is it's worth thinking about that in the case of Nick Cave and this song and my record, these things happening around the same time. Context is really important, and community is really important, and it's hard to separate these things out sometimes. But, you know, I don't think there's any way I could have proffered up a record like this when I was 25 or 30, and it's hard to tease out whether it's because I wasn't a brave enough songwriter or because I didn't have an audience there who I knew would hold me in the act of sharing things so painful. And I think, I don't know what Nick Cave would say if you asked him, but I would dare to venture that he has developed such a beautiful relationship with his fan base and his community, such a trusting, consensual, respectful, beautiful relationship that that he knew he was safe enough to write this kind of stuff. And I also looked, you know, watching that film of the making of this record and the recording of this song, one of the things in the film that actually brought me to tears multiple times was watching Nick Cave, without any words being exchanged and without anyone pointing to it in the film, there was this kind of fellowship. And Warren Ellis sitting there, literally creating a, you know, with a synthesizer on his lap, creating a bed of music and of sonic support so that on top of it, Nick Cave could speak these words, sing these words. And it was literally like watching the most powerful form of human friendship and support. And the fact that music was the language at play, it was such a powerful reminder of what we are able to do for each other creatively. You know, this whole group of guys just holding the space for him to be able to break down and break open.
I had a sudden urge to become someone like you, who started out with less than anyone I ever knew. In love, I love.
And John Congleton did the exact same thing for me when we recorded There Will Be No Intermission. And he was sort of the leader. He was like, you know, he was maybe the equivalent of my Warren Ellis, but there was also Jerick Bischoff in the studio and Max Henry. And I actually don't think it's a coincidence, and I don't think it should go unnoticed that they were all men. And especially given everything I've been through in my career, especially after like clawing my way off a major label to get out of a room of men who told me that my material was invalid, that I would wind up in this incredibly supportive environment with these male allies who were doing the same thing for me that Nick Cave's band were doing for him. They were literally holding this space together for me. You know, John wouldn't allow any assistant engineers at the session. And he sat behind his board with such grace and power and lack of judgment. And, you know, we didn't have to discuss it very much, but the message was, I am here for you. I'm going to sit here and support you while you do this thing, while you sit there in that space at that piano and sing about your miscarriage and your abortions and the death of your best friend, and I am just going to support you and do as little as possible or as much as possible. I am here to do what you need so that you can express these things.
Did she answer? No. Not a single heartbeat. No. So it's over.
Yes.
So you know the drill. You're the expert. Congratulations. You really got this death thing.
Just the act of being able to do that in a room with a bunch of men was almost more healing than writing the songs themselves, to feel so believed and so supported, not to fucking mention, you know, while we were in the studio, we were glued to our phones watching the Kavanaugh, Christina Blasey Ford face-off of doom. You know, and I looked around me at all of these guys who were looking at me saying, we not only believe you, we're going to help you do this. We're going to help you get this message out. We're going to help you. We're going to help you. And I was like, okay, well, progress is not happening in the White House. But it's happening in this teeny little studio in L.A.
Well, and one of the things that I've heard you talk about around this record is it sounds like you were really supported in making the record by both by the guys you made it with and by your patrons. And that a lot of some of the songs, specifically Voicemail for Jill, you kind of have adopted kind of a mindset, the way that you find Magneto like a very useful, it's very useful for a person who's grieving, that you actually wrote a song that you thought might be useful for a woman who was having an abortion or had been through one. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe the connection between feeling held and feeling supported and being able to make something that is useful and supportive.
Well, one of the things that I love about getting older as a woman, as a songwriter, as an artist, as a performer, you know, the collision of all of those things is I can look back at other copies of myself, you know, former versions of me at 15, at 25, and 35, and have a kind of awareness of what I needed then that wasn't available to me, that wasn't said to me. And the song Voicemail for Jill, I mean, following on what we were just talking about with the ride, I had been trying to write a good, sincere song about abortion for 20 years since I had my first one when I was 17. And I found it an impossible subject to tackle and get on top of. I just could not, as a songwriter, I could not figure it out. And every time I would sit down at the piano to try to write about it, I would just hit wall after wall and be at a complete loss. How do you write about abortion without being too preachy, too sentimental, too, you know, quote unquote, political, to just, how do you get a subject like that right? And especially, what's interesting is the older I got and the more known I got, and the more yelled at on the internet I got, I was like, I can't afford to get this wrong. I will get so yelled at. But I also really need to write this song. Because I could have used this. And, you know, in my 30s, when I had an abortion, I just thought, I am going to Google and there's nothing here. There is no handbook that everybody knows about that all women hand to each other, so you're going to get an abortion. You know, not only are we all standing with you and you're joining 1 in 4 women in America who's had one, we're all with you, but like, here's what you might be feeling. Here's how you can deal with it. Here are the resources. Here's the support. Here's the giant sign saying you're not alone on the other side of the highway next to the billboard with the bleeding fetus saying you're a fucking satanic witch. And I wanted to write that song and I couldn't figure it out. And it wasn't until I was in Dublin during the abortion referendum. And I mean, I got so inspired watching the women there who had fought so hard to get that legislation passed. And I came back and I was like, I think I know what this song needs to be. You know, it needs to be a really utilitarian song. And the way you write a utilitarian song is it's just, you stick it in the container of one woman talking to another woman, and then it's applicable everywhere. And I mean, not long after writing the song, I think a week after writing the song, I only had the MP3 demo on my phone. But I had a friend whose partner was going through an abortion, and I got to send it to her. Like, this might be useful. And she wrote back, and she was like, oh my God, that was really useful. Thank you. I needed that. It helped.
I'm not sure that you'll get this in time. I don't know if you're checking your voicemail at all, but in case it's the morning and you're off of the Green Line and walking through Copley, I want you to stop for a second. I want you to listen. You don't need to offer the right explanation. You don't need to beg for redemption or ask for forgiveness. And you don't need a courtroom inside of your head where you're acting as judge and accused and defendant and witness. It's a strange grief, but it's grief. Look at all the women in the street. You know the statistics.
And again, like, you know, I'm back in the arena of music criticism after 7 beautiful years of being away from it. And it's terrible because there are going to be people out there telling me that these songs are useless and too long and unimportant and invalid. And I have just never given less fucks because all I need is that text message back from that one woman who was helped. And you know, there's an interesting connection to be made between women and power and their voices, especially their voices as musicians, and who and what stands in the way of their ability to sing what they need to sing and say what they need to say. Because there's so many steps from the conception of a song or a fragile idea to the time that it becomes a finished song that y'all might listen to. And I think it's really important to be aware of every hurdle she needs to jump from the songwriting process to getting into the studio with her eye-rolling male engineer to, you know, jumping all the rest of the hurdles that you have to jump once that song is written. And I think it's really important, especially here at South by Southwest, to talk about all of those hurdles, because there are thousands of them. I have been, you know, I've been attacking the project of making and putting out music while simultaneously trying to make a living for 20 years. And I have hit a lot of walls and jumped a lot of hurdles. But I feel more powerful now than I ever have as a songwriter, and kind of therefore as a person. And it's a combination of getting to the point where I really have a much, you know, tighter and yet looser grasp on what it is I need to say and how I can say it, how it works, why it works. Because I've been writing songs since I was 12 and I'm 42. I've made a lot of mistakes. I've done a lot of things right. I have a real wealth of knowledge, which is probably a different topic for a different podcast, but you know, the fact that women actually do get better at music as they get older, to start dismissing them when they hit 40 is a huge misfortune in this culture. And to think that a woman has peaked as a musician when she is at the height of her fertility is a mistake. Because women are smart and they have a lot to say and a lot to share. But also, I've gone through, you know, 10 iterations of different teams to help me jump those hurdles and or run around them or duck under them. And that's also been very difficult. I've worked with a bunch of different men. I've worked with a bunch of different women. I've worked with massive managers. I've worked with college interns. My team right now, Haley, who's sitting here, my manager, Jordan, Michael, my assistant in my office, they have done the most exquisite job holding this space for me, like Warren Ellis style, John Congleton style. You know, John does it in the studio. These guys do it in my office in New York. They sit there and they write emails all fucking day and they laugh and joke with me while we're putting out a record this dark. And if I didn't have them, I know that it wouldn't be possible. And my patrons. And those three pillars, like my artistic collaborators, my industry team, and the 15,000 people who are like, I'll totally give you $3 a month just to hear what you have to sing. All of those things have completely liberated me to not think about music anymore as a thing that I have to sell and push and market, but to use music as the medicine that it can be for me, for the people listening to it, without a second thought about what else I have to do.
No one's gonna celebrate you, no one's gonna bring you cake, and no one's gonna shower you with flowers. The doctor won't congratulate you, no one on that pavement's gonna shout at you that your heart also matters. No one's gonna.
And this is voicemail for Jill from Amanda Palmer's latest record, There Will Be No Intermission. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I want to tell you that I really, really adore this record. I've cried, sobbed, really, deep cathartic sobs to like every song on this record. And as much as I've loved the record, I've loved the journey that getting ready for this interview took me on. Like, I dove deep. I watched the TED Talk. I read the book. When she was here, I went on this like Amanda Palmer journey. She and her husband, Neil Gaiman, had a read-in at the public library where they invited people to get together, gather silently, and read for half an hour. It was one of the most beautiful things I've experienced in my 19 years of coming to South by Southwest. I saw her three-hour show during the festival. Most sets are 40 minutes at South by Southwest. She played for 3 hours, and she's actually going on a tour with a three-hour show, y'all. Like you heard, I joined the Patreon, and I feel like I learned something important apart from just enjoying the record. You see, I'm lucky enough to work for public radio here at KUTX, and I love our model and our mission. We make a thing, radio and all the music and videos and live performances and events that come with it. And then we go to our listeners, and we ask for their support in making the thing. It's a lot like what Amanda Palmer does, right? She makes music and art and videos and asks her fans to support her ability to do so. But in making the thing, we, and I mean we here at KTX and Amanda Palmer, we're also doing something else. We're building and strengthening a community of people who in turn build us up and strengthen us. It's like the ultimate positive feedback loop. And my takeaway from all my Amanda Palmer research is twofold. First, it strengthened my understanding of how to engage with your community. Watching Amanda Palmer engage with her fans is like watching a masterclass in authentic two-way communication and has given me so many ideas to bring back to the station and to my own life. But it's also showed me that, especially now with platforms like Patreon, community can be a way forward for lots of people. Musicians and artists, yes, but really anyone who makes a thing that people value. If you're willing to take the time and effort to engage with the people who enjoy that thing you make, then you can create your own positive feedback loop where you and your community support each other. It's really exciting. Amanda Palmer will be going on tour starting this weekend, and she's probably coming to a town near you. You can find her tour dates on the show notes page for this episode at kutx.org. You can also find a link there to her new record, There Will Be No Intermission, and a link to her Patreon in case you want to check that out. And we actually Facebook Lived this interview, so if you want to see the original, unedited interview, you can find that link on the show notes page as well. And as always, you'll find a Spotify playlist there where you can hear all the songs we referenced in this episode all the way through. And Amanda Palmer is coming out with a podcast. So be on the lookout for that. And that's it. You've come to the end of another episode of This Song. This Song is a production of KUTX 98.9 in Austin, Texas. This episode was produced by Art Levy and me, Elizabeth McQueen. Thanks to our intern, Felix Kimbrell, for his help both at the live show and with getting this episode out. Thanks to Deidre Gott and Peter Babb and Todd Callahan for all they do for this podcast. And yes, it is true. Our theme song is Mahout by Austin's own Hard Proof. Right on. Thanks for listening.